Hey, I passed a roebuck today. Mitch, check last time. I don't know that this roebuck got to every row, so make sure that the roebuck's accurate here. Check the setup there. I'm not certain if it got around to every... Oh, yeah. Don't forget tomorrow, a vocabulary quiz. Do we have any questions about how to approach studying for that? Yes, Greg?
Will we have to remember the location of all the accents?
No, I'm not going to test you on that. I would recommend learning it as far as when you're learning the words, learn where the stress goes. And if you can, go ahead and memorize those, but you won't be required on the test. You won't be graded on the position of the accent.
I was able to get them all out before.
Oh, okay. If you want, for your own information, you can check with another student that's got them or check with me sometime to see and get them correctly. But you won't be required on the test to mark the accent. And I recommend, though, when you're sounding the word out, to put the stress where the accent is so the thing sounds right to you, so you get a pattern. Now, as we'll examine the accent rules later on, the place where you put the stress in the nominative case form may not always be the same as it is in other case forms. In other words, the stress may shift. You might have noticed already with anthropos, it starts out anthropos, and then when you have the genitive plural, it's anthropon, and you get the accent on the next syllable. This has to do with some kinds of accent rules that we'll be looking at a little bit later on. Not all words do it, but it has to do with where the accent started out, especially words that start out accented on the first syllable. There'll be a tendency to slide down with your genitive plural endings and some of the other types of endings with a real long syllable. So we'll... After we cover the dative case in Lesson 11, we'll be getting into accent rules. And but as far as this test is concerned, you won't be required to put the accent on it. I would recommend learning it as a part of it. Also, but do note that on this vocabulary test, you will be responsible for the article that goes on the noun, because that tells you the gender. So if I give you a noun, say scripture or something like that, writing, I expect you to write "Hey, graphe," put the article on it also. And also for the adjectives, you need to know the ways it makes its endings in the various genders, and that's given information with you with the noun. So go ahead and put that down. In other words, on the test, I'll be looking for the dictionary form of the noun, including the article, and the dictionary form of the adjective, including the endings for the feminine and the neuter. Okay, and on the test, I'll be doing it both ways. I'll be giving you some, in some cases, I'll give you the Greek, and you give me the English. Other cases, I'll give you the English, you give me the Greek. Okay, and that's always the harder one. All right, question? Well, spelling is super critical. The spelling is a critical thing. In English, maybe the spelling won't be quite as critical as it is in Greek. In Greek, it's very critical. And breathing marks, be sure you watch your breathing marks. And don't worry about accents, but breathing marks and spelling is very critical. Basically, I'll be giving you on the... each one will be worth something like 4 points each, and it'll be 1 point off for every letter or breathing mark that's wrong, up to a maximum of four. So you want to be sure you get those right. Okay, that's for tomorrow. Okay, for today, we're looking at Chapter 10, the genitive case. And if you'll turn to page 58 in the textbook, we'll resume our discussion of the genitive case and the syntax. We just began a discussion of the syntax last time. We looked at the forms, and we'll be completing, once we finish Chapter 11 to get all the case forms, then we'll write the whole paradigm on the board, and then you can copy that down for your own references and your paradigm references. But we're looking at the syntax of the genitive case. Just what does it mean? What's the reason for having a genitive case, and what kinds of meanings are associated with the function of the genitive case? In section 75, we looked at last time, we see the fact that basically we're dealing with a kind of a modification in which one noun is modifying another noun. And so I'll just go through that one more time. In Greek, a noun in the genitive case may occur in the syntactic positions proper to adjectives and has in such positions a meaning which may be reasonably subsumed under that of modification, which is expressed by adjectives in attributive positions. These semantic and syntactic characteristics of Greek nouns in the genitive are shared by the corresponding English constructions, that is, nouns in the possessive case written apostrophe S or S apostrophe, and nouns preceded by the function word of. So this is basic. This holds true in almost every case. Anytime you see a genitive phrase in Greek, you can translate it into English almost in every case with the preposition of. Not always with the possessive, most often with the possessive too, but almost always with the prepositional phrase of. Because as it turns out, the phrase of in English has about the same ranges of meaning as the genitive case does in Greek. So I won't say that about the possessive, because the possessive is kind of a special case of this, but even possessives can be written, can be expressed in English by the preposition of. In other words, if you want to say Bill's book, you could say the book of Bill. We might say that may be a little stilted, but that's the same understanding. And that's the essence of the idea of the genitive case in Greek. Now, we're going to be doing more detailed study of the genitive case later on, especially in the second year, where we'll be looking at these case functions in more detail, breaking down into various subcategories of the types of functions and uses that they have, and just taking note of those. But realize that there's only one case form in Greek. Now, we'll be talking later on about basically what he's using here is the four-case system, or sometimes called five-case, with the vocative, which we haven't dealt with yet. And there are some textbooks that use an eight-case system, where you have, instead of genitive, you have genitive and ablative, both, with the same case form. And then in the dative, they'll get into instrumental and locative as well. We'll be looking at those a little bit later on. It depends on the textbook that you're using. Some of them are vehemently arguing for eight cases. Others are vehemently arguing for four or five cases. What it really boils down to is the fact that there's really only four case forms. Form-wise, there's only four sets of forms that you have to learn in a paradigm. Function-wise, a person might argue for eight cases. But that's basically breaking up a particular case form into different functions, and that's including context and other things. So I think the whole matter can be resolved by just recognizing that there's four case forms, possibly five in some cases with evocative, and eight case functions. And we'll get into all of that stuff. That's lots of fun. We'll get into that in the second year. So I just wanted to let you know that in case you look at other textbooks that talk about the ablative and about the locative and then instrumental and so forth, and you don't see those words here. It's just because this is using the four-case system, and this is dealing mainly with the forms. We'll refine the functions a little bit later on, and then we'll introduce things like the ablative and other things along those lines. So we'll get to that in due time. Now, fortunately, there aren't separate case forms for all of those other functions, and we'd really have an interesting paradigm. If you had eight different case forms instead of four, of course your workload would be twice as great. Fortunately, it's not the case. Okay, section 76 then. In general, it is true that when a noun in any case is modified by a noun in the genitive case, the noun in the genitive is anarthrous if the noun it modifies is anarthrous, and articular if the noun it modifies is articular. So this is a general rule now. There will be some exceptions to this. But the general rule is that if your noun that you're modifying is anarthrous, the noun in the genitive that modifies it will be anarthrous. If the noun is articular, the noun in the genitive will be articular. So there's a general correspondence there between definiteness in the noun that's modified and the noun that's modifying. So Mark 13:39, we have huios theou, both anarthrous. Now, if that u is in the genitive case, it's modifying the noun huios. So it's telling what kind of huios. The translation they give here is a son of God. He gives a footnote here suggesting that since this is a predicate nominative in this particular verse, it may very well mean the son of God. You have to look at context and so forth. But I think most often you're going to see it without the article like this. You have to. We'll get into refinements on the use of the article and how to translate these things. And there's not always a real clear-cut case, like he says here, it may be translated the Son of God. I'd be inclined to translate it a Son of God unless I had a real strong reason otherwise. Sometimes it's theology that's making the difference there too. So take that with a grain of salt. Just recognize that there's a possibility there. Notice in the next statement, though, note the omission of the with God, which is treated like an English proper name. So in English, and this is especially true of the second example, ho theos tu theou. The Son of God. We don't say the Son of the God, because in English the word theos, coming from Greek, theos normally has the article in Greek, where it's not translated in English, because in English we treat God as kind of a proper name, so we don't need an article with it. Okay. So notice, though, the correspondence there. Huyos te'u, both anarthrous. Ho huyos tu'te'u, both articular. So this is the general rule that you'll see. You'll see articular nouns in the genitive modifying articular nouns, and you'll see anarthrous nouns in the genitive modifying anarthrous nouns. And remember, of course, that a noun in the genitive might modify a noun in any case. In this case, we've got nouns in the nominative. Huyos is nominative in both cases, and is being modified by a genitive phrase. But you'll see genitive phrases modifying nouns in the nominative, genitive, dative, or accusative cases. But the noun in the genitive, of course, will always be in the genitive case, regardless of what the case of the noun that it modifies is. You see, we've been used to seeing adjectives, and adjectives will take a case form dependent upon the noun that they're modifying. They'll agree in case, number, and gender with the noun that they're modifying. A genitive noun modifying another noun, of course, will always be in the genitive case, regardless of what the noun that it's modifying is. And it will not agree in gender either, because it's a noun. It's going to have its own gender. And so it's not agreeing really in anything with the noun that it's modifying, other than the fact that it's in the genitive case, and there's a structure that shows you that it's modifying the other noun. Yes, go ahead.
Another strange question for
you. Okay.
So the genitive noun modifies the genitive noun.
Right.
And if you say you have a nominative and a whole bunch of genitives after that,
mm-hmm.
Could you presume, or is it the presumption that all of these are modifying the one nominative, or that this
okay.
means all of these are modifying each genitive after? Mm-hmm.
Well,
how you tell?
Context is really your only guide in that, because there are cases of both ways. In other words, you will find genitive phrases that kind of have several sub-layers. In other words, where this you might have a string of genitives where this genitive modifies the one before it, and this one modifies the one before it, and this one modifies the one before it, and so forth. Or you might have a string of genitives which all of them are modifying the main noun. And it can get somewhat confusing. Generally, they will try within the syntax to try to make a distinction. One way you can do it sometimes, because well, you're getting into the positions of the genitive, but sometimes a genitive phrase, if they've got two genitive phrases and they want to make it clear that both are modifying the noun, you could stick one of them out in front and one of them after the noun, one on both sides. And that way you can see they're both modifying the noun. Whereas if you stick one this way and the other one modifying it behind it, then there'll be an ambiguity as to whether this modifies the original noun or whether it modifies the previous genitive. But by and large, you're going to have to rely on context, and usually it's not too bad, because certain types of phrases, when they're strung together like that, are going to be fairly understandable as far as what they're modifying. And there are certain particular patterns, but there is a potential ambiguity there. There's no question about it. And one has to look at context. It's the only way you can really tell. They will attempt to arrange things in such a way that the ambiguities are eliminated, but that is a possibility, very definitely. Okay, well, we'll keep our eyes open for that a little bit later on. When we're reading the text, there will be cases. I think perhaps one of the most ambiguous, there's another type of ambiguity that gets involved too as far as genitive case, and that has to do with the basic meaning of it. But there are a number of ambiguities associated with the genitive case that we do need to be aware of. So when we're making translations, we realize that there are several possibilities that exist, and we want to be aware of what possibilities do exist. And some cases, the thing can be resolved by further context. Other cases, God may be purposely not allowing, not giving any more context so that both meanings may be applied. And we'll keep our eyes open to that a little bit later on. Okay. Section 77 then. With an anarthrous noun, a noun in the genitive may either precede or follow. So this is, we're again looking at the positions that the genitive phrase can occupy, and these are going to be somewhat similar to the positions we've already been accustomed to under the heading of the adjectives. Remember, an adjective could occur, an attributive adjective could occur either before or after an anarthrous noun. If the noun was anarthrous, the adjective could occur before or after. The same is true of the genitive phrase. A genitive phrase can occur before or after an anarthrous noun, no difference in meaning. So let's look at a few examples. We have Romans 13:4. Theu diakonos means God's minister. Now, here we have theu is of God, and diakonos is minister. This is literally an of God minister, or God's minister, a minister of God. Okay, then to parallel that, look at Ephesians 6:21, pistos diakonos, a faithful minister. Now, there's an adjective, pistos, being used, and here all he's doing is showing you the fact that the genitive phrase position that we just looked at, theou diakonos, is parallel to the position that we saw with the adjective, pistos diakonos. So in other words, just like the adjective, the genitive phrase can occur before the noun with an anarthrous noun. And then Ephesians 6:6, douloi Christou, meaning Christ's slaves or slaves of Christ, slaves of Christ. Now there the genitive phrase, Christou, follows the anarthrous noun, douloi. But again, it's similar to what we saw with the adjective. Another example, douloi archeroi, worthless slaves. There again, the adjective is following the noun. So that's something we learned before. So all he's trying to establish here is that a genitive phrase can occur in the same position that an adjective does, either before or following an anarthrous noun. Now this holds only for anarthrous nouns so far. We'll get to articular nouns in the next section. And then we have our famous four positions here again. Okay, so genitive phrase on an anarthrous noun can occur either before or after the noun. No difference in meaning, possibly a difference in emphasis. That's all there would be. Okay, section 78. Now, what do we do with an articular noun? When an articular noun in the genitive modifies another articular noun, and that's generally the case, if a noun in the genitive is going to modify an articular noun, it will also be articular, generally. So that's our most common situation. That's the situation we'll deal with here. When an articular noun in the genitive modifies another articular noun, it may occupy any of the four positions which may be occupied by adjectives. Remember those four positions: the first and second attributive, and the first and second predicate positions. And those are the positions that we've already been familiar with the adjective. The first attributive position, the adjective came after the article but before the noun. Second attributive position, the adjective came after the noun but the article was repeated. And the predicate positions were essentially the same, except there's no article involved on the adjective. Either the adjective comes out before the article and its noun, or it comes after the article and its noun. All right, the same four positions occur with genitive phrases. The similarities and differences between A, constructions with genitive modifiers, and B, constructions with adjective modifiers are illustrated by the following examples. So let's go ahead and look at these examples, and you'll notice both similarities and differences in the way that the genitive phrase is used. First of all, first attributive position. This is the position where the adjective comes after the article but before the noun. The same is true of a genitive phrase. Look at the example. A, with genitive, ho tu kuriu matetes. Ho tu kuriu matetes means the disciple of the Lord or the Lord's disciple. The disciple of the Lord or the Lord's disciple. Notice that we have two articles in a row here, ho and tu. Ho tu kuriu matetes. But you see the tu kuriu, the article tu is going with kuriu, and that's your genitive phrase, and then ho is going with matetes. Now, this is exactly the same position as we've seen before with the adjective. Look at the following example. With the adjective, ho pistos matetes. Same position. Pistos coming between the article and its noun. Yes?
Well, we already mentioned, paragraph 76, that it's always going to have
article
as the usually always have article if the noun does.
Mm-hmm.
But you ever see it without that article? In that position.
Yes, you'll get that coming up. Ooh, let's see here. Ho kuriu matetes, in that form. Okay, you would only get that if, for some unusual reason, you wanted to say something like the disciple of a Lord, which would be very unusual. You could put that. That would still be considered the first attributive position. The only difference there was you didn't have an article in the genitive phrase. I don't know if you actually get it, huh?
That's a legitimate form.
Well, it would. There's nothing in the rules that prevent that from happening. There's no hard and fast rule that says you've got to have articular noun with articular. But that's the way it's most often done. Now, whether or not it actually occurs in the New Testament, I'm not sure. That would be the only question. It would be theoretically possible, let's say, but I don't know if it actually occurs in the New Testament or not. We just have to kind of keep our eyes open to see. Actually, in the New Testament, the position you'll find the most common is the fourth position here anyway, and that you may see one of both ways, but I'm not sure how often. He makes the statement here. It's a careful statement, you know. This is general true that. So we've got a general maxim here, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be always the case. Now notice that does not change the positions, the relative positions. The relative positions of attributive and predicate positions are determined by the relationship between the phrase and the noun it's modifying. And the noun it's modifying has got to be articular in order to have any sense out of these positions. But the noun and the genitive may or may not be articular. Let's just hold it as the general rule that it's going to be articular. And if there are any exceptions, we'll just have to note them as they come. But with regard to this particular specific example that you asked about, it would be theoretically possible to see that. I'm just not sure that you ever would. In other words, it's hard to imagine in this case the Bible ever talking about a Lord, you know, unless you were talking only about a human ruler or something like this, the disciple of a Lord. It's just kind of an unusual thing, just the way they normally speak. I doubt that it's going to come up very often. Yeah.
I just read this footnote down here, and that gives me another curve. He mentions the disciple of a Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean that because it's got articles in both ones. But a disciple of the Lord, could you say just tu curiu matetes without the whole, making that an anarchist, now it's modifying a disciple of the Lord.
Okay. That would be about as possible as the other. In other words, there's a possibility open for that. Just the question is if you're ever going to see it that way or ever see it said that way. Generally, if you want to say something like that, you'll see a little bit later on here that they will often use the verb to be, well, to get predicate positions, they'll use a different construction in order to get things that they couldn't get this way. And so I think you'd be more inclined to see something that's a little bit more stilted, more words involved in a more complicated phraseology in order to get those thoughts expressed. That would just be a matter of taking a poll throughout the New Testament and examining to see, you know, what uses you have. And apparently most of these books haven't bothered to do that. Or if they have, they haven't made mention of it because it's not used often enough to worry about. So his footnote here is the effect that, note that in the English, the definite article has the effect of making both nouns definite. The Lord's disciple does not mean either a disciple of the Lord or the disciple of a Lord, but only the disciple of the Lord. So this is essentially what you're coming up with in English. And that's just pretty much, if you just translate the article with both of these, you've got it pretty much straightforward from the Greek. But if you want to say either one of those other two phrases that he mentions there, it would require the omission of the article on one or the other of those, and I'm just not sure that you would actually see this kind of a construction in Greek. They'd probably try to say it some other way. Okay. B here with the adjective. Just notice that it's in the same position. It's in the same position as the genitive phrase, except that the genitive phrase, of course, has the article on it. Okay. Second attributive position. With a genitive, homathetes ho tu kuriu. It's the same phrase now, the disciple of the Lord, now in the second attributive position. And notice again, it's exactly the same as what we've seen with the adjective. We repeat the article on the noun, the same article that the noun had, and then put the genitive phrase with its article following that. So, homathetes ho tu kuriu, the disciple of the Lord, or the Lord's disciple. Then with the adjective, homathetes ho pistos. That's the same thing we've seen before with the second attributive position on an adjective. Okay, then the first predicate position. Now, this is where you're going to need to watch the difference in the translations. First predicate position. Now, predicate positions we've been normally associating with some form of the verb to be being supplied in English. But notice it says, tu kuriu homathetes, the disciple of the Lord. Now, what would you expect on the basis of your analogy to the previous use of the predicate position for the translation of that? Yes, Mark?
The disciple is the Lord.
Right. You would have expected the disciple is the Lord's. Because look at the bottom, the next example, pistos homathetes, the disciple is faithful. You see, the predicate position with an adjective involves a predication in which you're actually supplying the verb to be. And so, on the analogy to that, we would have expected tu kuriu homathetes to be the disciple is the Lord, but it's not. So this is where there's a deviation in this pattern. With the genitive phrases, you don't have what we would call a predicate position meaning-wise. Now, they still call this the predicate position as far as position is concerned, because it's convenient grammatically to describe these positions. But the meaning is not the same as it was with the adjective. When the genitive phrase is in a predicate position, the meaning is just the same as it was in an attributive position. There's no difference in the meaning. Maybe a slight difference in emphasis, that's all you could say, but no difference in meaning. So, tu kuriu homathetes is the disciple of the Lord, just as tu kuriu mathetes was. Okay, so no difference meaning-wise. The same is true of the second predicate position. Notice that one. With a genitive, homathetes tu kuriu, the disciple of the Lord, and with the adjective, homathetes pistos, the disciple is faithful. Here again, we have a predicate position, the second predicate position, but the meaning is just the same as it was within the attributive position. The disciple of the Lord, not the disciple is the Lord's. Question.
How would you say that the disciple is the Lord, the disciple is of the Lord?
You can say that in Greek, but what you will do is use a form of the verb to be. Yeah, you'll have to add the form of the verb to be, and then you can you could say, for example, homathetes estin tu kuriu, the disciple is of the Lord, or the disciple is the Lord's. Yeah, you could say it that way. I think you'll mention that in this next paragraph, but you would have to use a form of the verb to be in order to get that expressed. And that's, it's hard to know why they did it that way, but that kind of usage is going to be relatively rare. And so they've got a separate way to say that. But that can be said, but they'll use a form of the verb to be to do it. Okay? So basic difference here. The similarity is that the genitive phrase occurs in all four positions that the adjective occurs. The difference is that the genitive phrase has the same meaning. It's an attributive type of meaning in all four of those positions. If you want to get a predicate position with the genitive phrase, you'll use the form of the verb to be. Okay, so section 79 then, just a few observations about this. It should be noticed that the meanings of constructions like those of 1a and 2a, section 78, are similar to the meanings of constructions like those of 1b and 2b. That is, the noun and the genitive modifies the other noun just as an adjective modifies its noun. On the other hand, the meanings of constructions like those of 3a and 4a are not similar to the meanings of constructions of 3b and 4b. Neither tu kuriu homathetes nor homathetes tu kuriu means the disciple is the Lord's, as we might expect on the analogy of pistos homathetes and homathetes pistos. To express such a meaning as the disciple is the Lord's, an equative verb is normally present. Now, he does give a footnote here about exceptions. Exceptionally, down here the footnote, where the context is sufficient to make the meaning clear, no verb is necessary. So there are a few cases, for example, in 1 Corinthians 10:26, tu kuriu hege, the earth is the Lord's. He's saying that on a few occasions where there's enough, the context is sufficient to make the meaning clear, so there'd be no question about it, that you might see it happen. But normally you're going to see the equative verb used, and that'd be the pattern to expect. Okay, for nouns in the genitive, positions 1, 2, 3, and 4 are semantically equivalent, except for variation in emphasis. And he gives another footnote here, noting the fact that positions 3 and 4 are always called predicate positions, however, just as 1 and 2 are called attributive positions. So we'll keep the terminology of predicate position versus attributive position, even though in the case of genitive phrases, it doesn't really mean a whole lot as far as meaning. But it means something as far as position that it occupies in the sentence. And we'll see other types of adjectives and other types of words that will occur in these predicate and attributive positions, so we want to keep those positions in mind. When a noun in the genitive modifies another noun, it most frequently has position 4. Now, position 4 is recalled as the second predicate position, and that's where the genitive phrase comes after the noun with no repetition of the article. That's the most common way that you're going to see genitive phrase in Greek, and so you'll get used to seeing it that way. Homathetes tu kuriu. The disciple of the Lord, you see. That's by far the most common way that you'll see a genitive phrase, following the noun and in that second predicate position with no repetition of the article. I don't know what the exact percentages were, but I would guess over 75% of the time that you're going to see it that way. That's just a guess. It may be more than that. I wouldn't expect it to be too much less than that. So as we start doing some reading, of course, you can be watching now for these genitive phrases, at least the ones that you recognize. You won't recognize third declension ones, but you'll recognize the declension ones. And And you can watch for those positions. You'll see that that generally holds true. Now, he's going to give some examples, though, and he's going to give examples now that he's selected in various positions. In position 1, 1 Peter 3:20, he tu theou makrothumia, God's patience. So it's the patience of God, or God's patience. Notice here, tu theou is in the first attributive position. And then position 2, the second attributive position, we have 1 Corinthians 1:18, ho logos ho tu stauru, the word of the cross. Notice there, second attributive position, because we have the article repeated after the noun, and then the genitive phrase, tu stauru, following it. It's nice that he puts this in a boldface there, so you can see what's genitive and what's the other part, just to get used to this. Realize, of course, that in the actual real-life situation, it's not going to be in boldface for you, so you'll have to know the endings. And let me ask this. What if I wanted to say... Suppose the word of the cross, suppose the word was also in the genitive. In other words, suppose I was talking about the gospel of the word of the cross or something like this. Then I would have logos also in the genitive. And that would look like this. Tu logu tu staru. You'd have two twos in a row. Yeah. And so it's possible if you ever see two like that, you see two things in a row. It's because you've got one genitive phrase modifying another genitive phrase and in the second attributive position. So that can happen. That can happen. It's probably not going to be very real common, but it can happen. So be aware of it.
Would you repeat that again? Tu
logu, tu staru. Okay? That's the way, if you wanted to keep it in the second attributive position, that's the way you would say that if the word logos was also in the genitive case. Yes?
That put the emphasis on the cross?
There's a little bit more emphasis on the cross when you put it in the second attributive like that, where you have the article repeated. More emphasis than there would be, say, in just saying ho logos tu staru, which would be the most common way to say that. To say ho logos ho tu staru puts a little bit more emphasis upon the cross, because you've got that article repeated, and it's kind of setting something off, and it functions very much that way. So that would be a little bit more emphatic. And whether or not this would be more emphatic than, say, the first attributive position, where you could say ho tu staru logos, I think it's kind of a toss-up almost between those two as far as emphasis is concerned. You kind of have to feel it from the whole sentence, too. It's hard to say just in a phrase which would be more emphatic. You have to kind of look at the way that the author's been talking. See, lots of times it depends upon the way that the author normally does it. If you've got an author that consistently uses first attributive position and then all of a sudden he uses second attributive, then your attention's called to it, and vice versa. Those factors get involved too. Okay, then the third position, Matthew 1:18, tu Jesu Christu hegenesis, the birth of Jesus Christ. So hegenesis is birth, and we get a word genesis from that, of course, and beginnings, origin, and he says, he's got a footnote down here. This position is quite uncommon and very emphatic. So, hegenesis is now a third declension, so if you're wondering why it's got an iota sigma ending on it with a he, that's the third declension noun. But here, tu Jesu Christu hegenesis. This is more emphatic, and this is really emphatic on the genitive end, because the whole thing's being put out in the front, and then the noun is being stuck at the end. So, and I think it really gets more emphasis from the fact that you don't see this very common. The thing that you see less commonly becomes more emphatic. So that's perhaps more than any other reason why this is so emphatic. And then 2 Corinthians 13:13, hey, agape tu theou, the love of God. That's the fourth position, or the second predicate position. That's by far the most common, and that's probably the least emphatic on the genitive, because it is the most common. Okay. Any questions on those positions? So the bottom line is, genitive phrases can occur in all four positions that adjectives can occur, but the meaning is always attributive in all four of those positions. You don't have a predicate position meaning. To get that predicate idea, you'll use the form of the verb to be normally, with a few exceptions. Okay? Any problems? Yes?
Only one question. Does it matter whether you translate it with the possessive or the...
No, I don't think so. For now, at least, we're not going to worry about that. in some cases, though, a possessive might not be the most appropriate. You just have to examine it in each case. He'll give you a few more ranges of examples further on down in this next section, so that you'll begin to see that not a possessive may not always fit. Of will almost always fit. So what I would say is just use your own judgment as to which you think fits the best in English idiom, and just realize those two choices, either a possessive or of, and we're not going to be too worried about it as far as grading and so forth is concerned, as long as it makes some sense. All right. Okay, section 80. As we've indicated, the Greek genitive case in the constructions we've been discussing has meanings which are generally comparable to those expressed by the English possessive or the English phrases with of. Broadly speaking, we may define the genitive meaning of the genitive as a construction of modification, in a construction of modification to be one of dependence or belonging. That is, whatever is denoted by the noun which is modified in some way is in some way dependent on or belongs to whatever is denoted by the noun in the genitive. So the basic meaning, basic idea then is that when you stick a genitive phrase on something, you're making that something somehow dependent upon or belonging to the thing that's in the genitive. And so you're generally denoting this particular thing you're talking about as being in a certain kind of class denoted by the genitive, or somehow dependent on that idea that's denoted by the genitive. And later on, when we look at we'll see that the genitive case is often called a case of definition. It defines something, it relates something to another class or group, it tells you the kind of thing that it is and what kind of category, whatever, or tells you what it belongs to, what it is associated with, what it's dependent on. So that's the general idea of it. We'll make that even more general later on the second year and then look at more specific subcategories for it. But for now, that's a convenient way to describe it. It is the noun of the genitive is somehow describing the noun that it's modifying in such a way that the noun that's being the noun that's being described is somehow dependent on or belongs to whatever is denoted by the noun in the genitive. Let's look at these examples and see how that applies. In traditional grammars, various subdivisions of this general meaning are listed. Now, we will get into those a little bit later on. We'll get into genitive of kind, we'll get into objective genitive, subjective genitive, and so forth. There's a whole series of subcategories that have been made up by grammarians. Now, realize that in the Greek text, you don't find a clear distinction between an objective genitive, a subjective genitive, a genitive of kind, and genitive in apposition, these types of things. Those are categories that have been made up by the grammarians who've looked at the way that they've been used. And so they look at the way they're used and they say, now how do we render this in English? And then they come up with certain categorizations. In Greek, all you have is a genitive case form. And a genitive case form is functioning in a certain set of ways. And I think this is important to make an important point to make, which I will make more later on, that the subcategorizations that you find in Greek grammar books are not always given by inspiration of God. They are things that grammarians, and that's why you'll find one textbook has a different subcategorization than another textbook. You'll find them differ, because they just break it down into different groups. They both got the same basic idea that it's being used in a number of different ways as far as English idiom is concerned. But don't treat those as being absolute truth. Don't try to settle a theological argument by the fact that Dana and Manti says that this is an objective genitive, whereas some other guy says it's a subjective genitive. You can't settle a theological issue that way, because all you know from the Greek is that it's a genitive case form. And anything more than that is opinion based on the observer. And so since you're an observer and they're observers, they came down this way, this guy came down this way, you might come down a different way altogether. You may make it known that these scholars came up this way, these scholars came up that way, but that is not going to ultimately decide the issue. We need to know some more information. Usually the issues like that are going to have to be resolved by the general tenor of Scripture and by the context and other things. That's usually where these guys get their viewpoints too, but their general interpretation of the general tenor of Scripture may be different than yours, because maybe they don't believe in the baptism of the Holy Ghost speaking in tongues, or they believe in a triune God or something like that, and that's going to be reflected in the way that they translate some things sometimes. So I'll be hitting this point over and over again, but this is one aspect that you may not here in the average Greek class, because most of them are so locked into this traditional format that they can attach too much dogmatism to certain things that there's really no justification for. And if you're stuck with, if you're looking at only one textbook and never consult any other things, you may think that that's the gospel and everybody agrees on it, but it's not the case at all. You really need to be careful. There are some things you can be very clear about and very dogmatic about, to use that term, but there's other things where it starts getting into interpretations of the use of certain things. Then you've got to be careful. Keep your eyes open and watch. And I'll be trying to point out those things to you as we go, especially in the second year. We'll be looking in more detail as to that. We'll get into things like use of aorist participles and other things that have generated some theological controversy based on a distinction in Greek grammar that may or may not be there, depending on who you're reading. Okay? We'll have some fun with that as we go. Okay. Let's look at these examples then, and you'll get an idea of the kinds of uses that you'll see the genitive in. These are typical types of references using the genitive. Romans 1:1, doulos Jesu Christou. That's a very common phrase in Paul's epistles, a servant of Jesus Christ or a slave of Jesus Christ. And there you see your fourth position or your second predicate position there for Jesu Christou. Actually, it wouldn't even be that because it's an anarthrous noun, so it's just following the noun. You really need an articular noun in order to define those positions. But this next one is in that position, Romans 1:1, to evangelion, to theou, the gospel of God, or God's gospel. You see, sometimes it's more appropriate to say gospel of God than God's gospel. We don't normally in English talk about God's gospel. You could. I mean, there's no reason why the genitive phrase couldn't be translated that way. But that's why I say that sometimes it's more appropriate to use of. In fact, that's what he's done in all these cases. Matthew 4:23. Yes, Glenn?
This is infamous one case where God's gospel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very distinct. God, gospel.
Right.
The gospel of God is about that kind of
right. thing. See, that's the point. If you translated God's gospel, then you've made it possessive. And you've narrowed down the range of meanings that are possible from the genitive. You see, in the Greek, this genitive phrase could be, and this is where the ambiguities come in, it could be instead of God's gospel, gospel belonging to God, it could be the gospel that came from God. God was the source of it. See? Or it could be the gospel that's about God, concerning God, the gospel of God, the gospel that's about Him. So this is where these different distinctions come in, and this is where certain ambiguities come. And it's the same kinds of ambiguities come from the English phrase of as come from the genitive. That's why of, I think, is a better translation on the whole than saying a possessive except in cases where the possessive is really obvious from the context. Some cases, it's just obviously possessive. There's no question about it. But if it's not obviously possessive, I would recommend a translation of, just because that in English, our range of meanings of is about the same as the range of meanings of genitive in Greek. And so you're being just as ambiguous as the Greek is, and you preserve the ambiguity if you want to say it that way. So you're accurately transmitting the ambiguity. So that leaves it open, you see. The phrase, the gospel of God, and then another phrase here, the gospel of the kingdom. Just what is the gospel of the kingdom? Is it the kingdom's gospel? The gospel belongs to the kingdom? Well, yes, perhaps, but it seems to be even more than that. The gospel coming from the kingdom, the gospel about the kingdom, concerning the kingdom, the gospel which is the kingdom, that's what we call more of an objective genitive. There's a number of possibilities that exist there, and somehow, of course, you're seeing, though, that the gospel is being defined by the kingdom. It's the kingdom kind of gospel. So the phrase of the kingdom is modifying the idea of gospel. It's not just any old gospel, but it's the gospel of the kingdom. It's not just any old gospel, but it's the gospel of God. So it's defining that gospel and bringing it into a more sharp focus. Okay? Mm-hmm.
Context the only way you're having narrowing down the meaning then, or is there a specific way of saying each one of these variations, like gospel, which is the kingdom of gospel from the kingdom?
You know,
the kingdom's gospel. Is there
any
literal way to say God's gospel?
Well, as far as God's gospel is concerned, generally you use the genitive. If you want to make it more precise as far as these other ranges, there are other prepositions that could be used that would define such a relationship more precisely. The trouble is, though, that as long as you've only got a genitive form here, then you do have quite a range of ambiguity that's going to have to be decided by context. In some cases, context isn't even enough. In other words, there are examples where in Pauline epistles, where I'll be bringing something and I'll bring out the fact that it's in the genitive, understand, it could be subjective or objective gender. There's a number of possibilities within this context that exist. And in some cases, we just have to give those possibilities. In some cases, it may be intentional. I'm convinced that there are some places that are intentionally done this way, intentionally ambiguous, so that the range of... And by ambiguous, I don't mean that it's... there's two widely divergent meanings. They're very, very close. It's just a slight shade of difference. And the slight shade of difference, of course, sometimes God doesn't want to make a slight shade of difference between those. It's just basically... and remember, too, that part of the problem is that we're trying to express in English what's there in Greek. The Greek may not have been intending to refine all those different shades of meaning, but included the whole works, just under the whole category of definition. It's the gospel that comes from God. It's the gospel that's possessed by God. It's the gospel about God. It's it's all of those. It's the gospel of God, That's what it is, you see. And I think that may be part of the problem, is we're trying so hard to narrow this down a little bit more in English. And that may be part of the problem. So there are ways, though, to say a gospel about God. You could use peri, concerning God. You could. There's other prepositions that could be used to get a more definitive refinement. And that lets me know that because other prepositions are available to get more definitive refinement, that if the genitive is used, it may be purposely used to expand the range of meaning and to give a fuller, broader thought. So that's something to keep in mind, especially in the second year. We'll do some more work on this and discussion of this. But I think it's one of the most interesting facets of Greek, is that there are such ambiguities, and context will often define them enough, but in many cases you'll find that even with the context there's ambiguities. The just shall live by faith, and there's other phrases like that, where in the Greek you find genitive phrases that really open the thing up. It just becomes expansive. And you see many different facets that are possible there, and then you'll find scripture that will pick up different facets of it, and will confirm that fact, will confirm the fact that there was an intentional expansion of the idea, because other scriptures will go off and take off in this branch of it, and then they'll take off in that. And Paul does that quite frequently in his epistles, picks up on these ambiguities and elaborates on them, as it were. Okay, so that's some more subject for future study, especially the second year. And then on your own as well, especially in the second year, we'll be emphasizing the fact that with the genitive, consider your options, consider the possibilities. Don't be restricted to a certain narrow viewpoint of the thing, because it may not be that way at all. And don't necessarily be stuck with the way the translators decided to render it. The translators may be colored somewhat by their theological framework and in the way they're translating something like this. Okay, and a few other examples. Ho elachistos ton apostolon, the least of the apostles. So here again, we see this is the most common position, the second predicate position. But here we have the genitive phrase in the plural. And Paul is talking about himself as the least of the apostles. And this would probably be understood in the sense of, you could say the apostles least. The apostles, the least one possessed by the apostles, but that's probably not, Paul doesn't consider himself as being possessed by the apostles. But he is the least within that group, you see, the least out of that group. So in some cases, you might even see the preposition ek used just to narrow that down real clearly. You might see something, elakistos ek ton apostolon, or something like that. You see a preposition that will further define it. But without that preposition, the context is pretty much giving you the same idea, although it may connote both the idea that he's coming, he's within the group of the apostles, and the idea that he's being defined as being in that group, and then he's got qualities and characteristics like the other apostles. You see, it's got several facets to it, even in that sense. Okay, Hebrews 12:15, Rizza Pikrias, a root of bitterness, both anarthrous here, and the genitive phrase following the noun. Okay, got five more minutes. We can finish this up, and then you'll be able to do lesson 10. Maybe I'll make that assignment now. Finish lesson 10 in the workbook. You had a few more sections. We did A, B, and C in class, so you've got, I don't know how many sections, E, F. Well, you still got D, E, and F to do. Those are fairly short. Huh? Boy, we got a test tomorrow, don't we? well, let's go ahead. Let's do it this way. Go ahead and I'd rather you study for the test. We'll go through this in class tomorrow. If you don't get it done, we'll just do it together in class. But if you do get a chance to do it ahead of time, you'll get two exposures to it, and that'll be that much better. But I don't want to put it off too much because I want to get into that dative case situation tomorrow. Now, let's look at the last two examples he's got here in which the Greek genitive is best translated by an English adjective. Now, again, best translated is kind of a matter of opinion, too. Depends on what you think sounds the best. And you may agree in some cases, you may not. But Luke 18:6, here's an example. Hokrites tes adikias. Hokrites tes adikias. Now, he's saying, translate this, the unrighteous judge. Literally, it's the judge of unrighteousness. The judge of unrighteousness. That's the way it's phrased. Now, I guess I'm more inclined to pay attention to the way the Greek worded it, because there is a way to say unrighteous judge using an adjective. In other words, Greek has an adjective for unrighteous, just adikaios instead of dikaios. So you could say ho adikaios krites and get the unrighteous judge. But they've chosen in Greek to say ho krites tes adikias. I think that's a little bit more emphatic. The judge of unrighteousness is more emphatic to me than the unrighteous judge. And that's a feeling that you sense from the Greek. And admittedly, you could translate it unrighteous judge, but I think you're losing a little bit of emphasis when you do that. So there's my opinion on that. I would rather be a little bit more literal and try to translate it literally and get a certain feeling and sense from that. And you'll see Rotherham and so forth do that too. He'll make the distinction between these types of uses, because very often you'll have a choice of either using an adjective or taking the noun form that's from that adjective and putting it in the genitive. And I think that the latter is more emphatic. Yes.
Doesn't differentiate the shape of being like an unrighteous judge could be somebody who is unrighteous,
mm-hmm.
whereas the judge of unrighteousness is completely different. It could be a judge who's judging unrighteous people.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, that could be the ambiguity with an objective genitive versus subjective genitive. You could be a man who's judging unrighteous people, and the context would have to decide which it is too. There's another reason why using the genitive phrase might be more important, because such an ambiguity wouldn't be transmitted by the adjective usage. The adjective usage pretty much narrows it down, whereas this opens it up. It's a good point, and so that's why I think it's. My basic philosophy is that if Greek has two ways of doing things, there's a reason to choose one over the other in the mind of the reader. It's not just a matter of, well, I feel this way this time and this way this time. There's a reason for it, especially if the Holy Ghost is writing this book to us. If we're dealing with classical Greek authors or something, we may not need to be as precise. But because we're dealing with something that is dealing with a covenant relationship between us and God, I think it's important to pay attention at least. Not to build a gigantic theological case on something, but pay attention to whether something's in the genitive phrase or whether it's an adjective, when both are possible. Just take a look at that. So judge of unrighteousness. In the context, it may be that the man, he's a judge who epitomizes unrighteousness. In other words, he's the epitome of unrighteousness. He's a judge of unrighteousness. Or he could be someone who's judging unrighteous people. That's possible, too. Context would have to decide that. James 1:25, akroates epilesmones, a forgetful hearer, or literally a hearer of forgetfulness, a hearer of forgetfulness. You see, that's got a little bit more punch to it, to my mind, than just saying a forgetful hearer. He's a hearer of forgetfulness. This is kind of a Hebrewism, actually. The Hebrews oftentimes talk about a son of disobedience and this type of thing, somebody who characterizes that. And that's the same kind of phraseology that is occurring here. And that's another thing that I think is important to get transmitted. Some of these Hebrew types of expressions and idiom, it's good to get those transmitted somehow. Now, I will admit that in a translation that you're trying to gear toward an English reader just to get a thought across, you may not be so concerned about those details. But we're as scholars of the Word and studying the Word and trying to teach the Word of God, we want to be very careful to make every distinction we possibly can and point those things out. Sometimes it can make a lot of difference in the way that the truth is received. Okay, so for tomorrow, that quiz, and if you have time, go ahead and finish lesson 10. If not, we'll go through it in class tomorrow after the quiz. Mm-hmm.